I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. Perplexed by the inner workings of our nation's capital, baffled by Beltway politics, the man behind the daily Politico playbook knows how to untangle it all. This hour, Politico's chief White House correspondent Mike Allen joins us to talk about the daily feature that has made him the man Obama's team wakes up to. Probably the most plugged-in journalist in Washington, Allen has the inside scoop on how the capital city works. We'll also get the latest installment of 90 Mile View, and Brian McTavish returns with the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. The most powerful or important journalist in the nation's capital? By consensus, that would be Politico's Mike Allen, whose must-read playbook each morning sets the tone in D.C. and is read by anybody who's anybody, including the White House. Yes, President Obama's team wakes up each morning to what Mike Allen writes. Mike Allen is a chief White House correspondent for Politico. He's worked for Time Magazine, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. Mike Allen was in town last night to speak to an audience at the Kansas City Public Library. A bit later this hour, we'll bring you our latest installment of 90 Mile View, and Brian McTavish returns with our weekend to-do list. But first up, Politico's Mike Allen. And Mike, welcome to Kansas City. So good to have you here.
Well, Steve, thank you. It's a treat, and I got to wander around the revitalized downtown, really enjoying it. So it's a treat to be here at KCUR, Kansas City's uncommon radio.
There you go. It's a good-looking town, isn't it?
Amen.
We're coming. Well, the man the White House wakes up to each morning, that's kind of a responsibility, isn't it?
Well, here at Politico, we have a great team that comes together, and the idea is to tap into what's going to be driving the conversation in Washington in a given morning. People wake up, and what are we going to be talking about? Steve, I think you'll agree that these days, if you care about a piece of news, you probably already know it, right? It comes to you in email, or you maybe see it on Facebook.
Yeah.
And so we try and be forward-looking to look at what is going to be on TV that night. What are newspaper editors going to be looking at for the next day? What is Time Magazine, David Vondrelli's employer, going to be looking at for the following week?
You know, some might argue, Mike, and I know you're hearing this a lot these days, that Washington right now is overcovered by the media, given that Congress is doing so little. In fact, you know, some bureaus like McClatchy, the company that owns my newspaper, they've pulled back on their coverage of The Hill. Is The Hill getting too much attention these days, given the output?
Yeah, and we don't measure the attention in inches as you and I used to, or in minutes. But we try and look at what's happening behind the curtain. My boss, Jim Vandehei, and I have a column that we actually call Behind the Curtain, because the idea is that when the cameras are off, when they're doing things out of sight of us, that that's when the real conversations take place. And so what Politico tries to do is take you into those. You know, one of the ideas that Jim and John Harris, the other founder of Politico, had is that reporters are a lot more interesting in a bar or when you're having a sandwich with them than they are in the newspaper.
You know, I've noticed that over the years. What's that about?
On the website. I mean, sometimes it comes with a pint. Like, that helps explain it. But our idea was that you shouldn't have to run into a reporter at Little League or at Sunday school or even in a bar to find out what's really happening. And that's what Politico tries to do, is close that gap between what's really happening and what we've been able to report in the past in using the sort of more conventional approach to journalism.
I guess what I'm wondering is, why should anybody wonder what's really happening when what's really happening ain't much?
Well, that's true with Congress, and they're not passing a lot.
15 bills so far this year. 15, Mike.
But I think some of your listeners will argue they don't want them doing any more.
That's right.
Whenever I see these stats that say Congress isn't doing anything based on how many hours they're in Washington or how many bills they're going to pass, I'm going to say that that's not necessarily the job of Congress. I can tell you there's a lot of people out there in the country who would just assume that their member be home working for them or doing work for them otherwise and not passing things. But to pull back the camera, you're totally right about this freeze in Washington. The two ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, the White House and the Capitol, very Mars and Venus these days. They just don't talk to each other. And when you talk to friends of Speaker John Boehner, the Republican who runs the House, you talk to them about what it's like for him to negotiate with Barack Obama. And here's the sort of Republican view of this, and then I'll give you the White House view of this. Mm-hmm. The Republican view of this is they sit down with the president and he says, okay, I won. Here's what we're going to do. House Republicans say, we won too. That's why we're here. And they resist the White House telling them what needs to be done, even though the president is always going to have the upper hand. And he also has Democrats controlling the Senate on his side. You know, some Republicans who've been in the White House negotiating were telling us that, say, House Republicans are at 100 and the president is at 50. And it wouldn't take long for you or me or most of your listeners or Joe Biden to wind up at 75, right in the middle. But the Republican view of this is the president will spend months telling us why 50 is right and our 100 is wrong. John Boehner will tell you the reason that he gets along pretty well, surprisingly well, with the Democratic leader of the House. He used to be the speaker before he won the majority, Nancy Pelosi. He says, I get that Nancy Pelosi is never going to be a Republican, and she knows that I'm never going to be a Democrat, and so we get along fine. But this president will try to convince you otherwise. Now, to give you the White House view of this, the Democratic view of this, they say, we spent months, years trying to negotiate with John Boehner. He can't get the Republicans who work for him, who are part of his caucus, part of his conference, to vote. So we can't necessarily make a deal that we're going to keep. And there's great frustration. And so this White House has looked away from Capitol Hill and is trying to do more things through executive order, things that they can do with the president's stroke of a pen or that the administration can do without Congress.
Politico's Mike Allen is our guest. I want to quote something out of your playbook from Tuesday morning. And this is an excerpt of a Gerald Seib column from The Wall Street Journal that day. Jerry wrote this, cold, hard data show that the Senate today is nearly as partisan and polarized as the House and more polarized than at any point in its recent history. Moreover, a body once noted for attracting people of stature from across society is filled more and more with professional politicians. Last year, in fact, 42 members of the Senate listed prior occupations in public service or politics before coming to Congress. In 1991, the number listing that as their background was 5. So how has the U.S. Senate evolved? How has it changed, Mike?
Yeah, well, Steve, thank you for reading Politico Playbook, our early morning email, and we try and find nuggets like this. We try and read 1,000 stories and find the 10 that you
and
would
you
like.
Read all 1,000?
Skim them, maybe we'll say
might
that.
Might be the better word.
But we look for nuggets like this. I had not heard that before.
I had not heard that before either.
I thought it was very fascinating how many former House members there are. But it's points to why, as you said at the top, so little is getting done. And the problem is that if you look at the reasons Washington is frozen, the reason is Washington is locked up, there's no short-term indication that it's going to change. In fact, it could get worse. If you look at the House Republicans who were elected in November, only a couple of them are from districts that also elected Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. And so they don't have an incentive to make deals with him. Now, looking ahead to the future of the National Party, they might. But if all politics is local, as they said, as Tip O'Neill, right? And so they're looking at their districts and they're saying, why should I make a deal with President Obama? At the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, they're saying, these people just want to defeat me. They're not looking for what would help the country. They're just looking out for their own interests. And as my grandmother would say, 'twas ever thus. That's how politics works.
I'm just struck by this notion of the professional politician nature of the U.S. Senate. As you were talking, I was just spinning through my own head the Kansas congressional delegation. I think every single member of that delegation was a professional politician prior to their current position. What a change.
It really is. Another change is that promotes this sort of partisan stalemate is that they don't spend as much time together across the road. You know, when I was a high school intern in Washington, it was not uncommon. This was decades ago. It was not uncommon for a House member to have his kids in the local schools in Fairfax County or Alexandria. Now that's almost unheard of because they would be seen as a sellout to
as
Washington.
An insider, a D.C. insider, if they wound up living out there.
Exactly right. And so young members of Congress like Paul Ryan of Wisconsin, his family lives back in Wisconsin, and he's only there on the three-day weekend. And so the minute that they can leave Washington, they do because there aren't the ties to keep them there. About the only time that the two parties come together is maybe a charity event or a book party. But they're rare because they're not there and they don't have structures that would bring the two parties together so they could get to know each other and chat and get things done in a less formal way.
You know, Mike, something else you just wrote for Politico and about one of the big issues that Congress is grappling with. You wrote this in private conversations. Top Republicans on Capitol Hill now predict comprehensive immigration reform will die a slow, months-long death in the House. Why? This is supposed to be the one initiative that was going to get through both houses of Congress. Why not?
Well, and Steve, even more importantly from a historic point of view, or very importantly from a historic point of view, this was the one big accomplishment that President Obama was going to have in his second term.
He could walk away virtually with a goose egg, right?
Yeah, they're implementing Obamacare, as they now call it. It used to be that was a term that Republicans used, but now the president has used it himself. The campaign has used it. And that looks like it's just going to be trouble, at least in the short term. So you're right that immigration was very important to national Republican leaders said that they needed it. But what we're seeing is this incentive for Republicans to do it just isn't there. They're talking about doing some little pieces, but even those are going to take a while, probably not until Congress comes back in September. And they're talking about doing one piece of border security in September, and then another piece they could all agree on, for instance, a system to track people who come in the country on visas, because now we don't know when people live. But that doesn't get you toward the big piece of immigration, the centerpiece of the Senate bill, which is some path to legal immigration for people who are now here illegally. No sign the House is headed that way, which means no big signing with the president.
You also wrote this, like with background checks for gun buyers, the conventional wisdom that the party would never kill immigration reform and risk further alienating Hispanic voters was always wrong and ignored the reality that most House Republicans are white conservatives representing mostly white districts.
Steve, that's right. And we talked to congressmen who go back home and have town meetings. And these House Republicans say that not only do people in the town meetings tell them they don't want to do anything on gun control, they tell them they don't want them doing anything ambitious on immigration and specifically, and as you know from covering them, the people you get at these town halls are often very knowledgeable.
Yeah.
And they know about the Senate bill. And House Republicans, like there's a congressman from Arkansas, Tom Cotton, an amazing guy. He's from Harvard. He was an army officer in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he says that his members, his constituents, tell him in overwhelming numbers at town meetings back home in Arkansas, where he likely is going to run for Senate coming up, that they don't want him to do what the Senate bill did, that it doesn't have the assurances in it that Republicans would need. Steve, a very interesting thing that we hear from House Republicans is that their big objection to the way that the Senate bill did on immigration is it puts too much trust in the administration. There's too much discretion for the administration and specifically the Homeland Security Department. And what they'll say is that the president's not even implementing Obamacare the way he said he was going to by pulling back on the employer mandate. And of course, Republicans like that, but they're using it as a club to beat the president to say, if you won't even stick to what you were going to say on your signature accomplishment, how do we know that you're going to enforce every part of immigration, even the parts that you may not like or that you may not think are good for the country?
Politico's Mike Allen's our guest. He's been called the most important journalist in our nation's capital. He visited with us on Wednesday. You know, I want to talk to you a little bit more about Politico and the playbook itself and how you manage to do what you do. The Politico playbook, it's a compilation of key stories, scoops, insider dope. It's essentially a reporter's notebook, only in this case, it's a reporter's notebook of one of the most plugged-in guys in America. What do you want the playbook to be? What's the objective? You talked about setting the agenda every day. What else does it need to do?
Yeah, Steve, the idea is to let you know what people in Washington are thinking and talking about in the morning. As they start their day, what topics are obsessing them? And it's not always what's on the front page of the paper. And it can be something in media. For instance, I saw the Kansas City Star very smartly played up the story about Google looking into being a replacement for cable TV. That's something that's going to affect everyone. It's a huge business story. It's a huge social story.
So you grab it and you pop it up.
A huge technology story. And so we'll point you to that. Also, we pass on what we're hearing. For instance, when Liz Cheney, the vice president's daughter, announced in Wyoming that she was going to run against a sitting Republican senator who's pretty popular.
We thought she was his friend.
Right.
He said.
Right. And that's pretty rare. Anyway, one of our readers was walking their dog and heard from someone who'd been hired to make a video for her campaign. And they said this is only going to be a one-shot job because after that, all the videos will have to be made in the home state. And so they figured out from that Liz Cheney was going to be making a video announcing that she was going to run. Also, you don't make a five-minute video announcing you're not going to run. So the fact that it was 5 minutes also suggested to him.
So someone told you that, and so you were able to glean and get a jump on the story.
Exactly.
That's true. So how are you keeping up with all this stuff every day? The Times did a profile of you a few years back saying you receive 2,000 emails a day. How do you do it?
Yeah, well, Steve, a lot of what we get comes from our readers, our people who read us on email, read us on our app, read us on politico.com. And if it's interesting to them, it's probably interesting to us. Politico Playbook started as an email that I did for just two people, for my bosses, John Harris and Jim Van High. It was what was going to be happening that day, what we should be covering, what we'd missed, what our competitors were up to. And John Harris mentioned to Howard Wolfson, who then was the communicator for Senator Clinton's presidential campaign. Now he's a deputy mayor of New York. He said, you know, Mikey gives me this great email in the morning that tells me what's going on. And Howard came to me and said, could I have a copy of it? And I'm like, sure. So I sent it to him. And then his deputy, Phil Singer, wanted it. And then the Obama campaign. And then the White House. And then the RNC. And then the DNC. And then the reporter from the New York Times. And then a reporter from McClatchy. And I was sending it out individually to all those people, forwarding them one at a time, because I figured people don't like BCC. And it was taking a half hour just to forward the email. So at some point I said, you know, guys, you're going to be getting this by BCC, but you'll get it a half an hour earlier. And people like that. People always want it earlier and shorter. So my family's out in Portland, Oregon, and they get it at a great time. I guess it'd be even better in Hawaii.
Yeah. So you're compiling this throughout the day. You're putting notes away. You're stashing stuff. I mean, you've got to be working. You're clearly a fairly fast-moving guy. How are you compiling all this stuff during the course of a day?
Yeah, Steve, thank you for asking about that. And it's fun because it's what our friends are talking about. It's what the people that we cover are talking about. It's the people that we run into around town are about Washington, very much a company town where you're probably going to be involved in politics or at least follow it. In our church, we have a variety of people who either are working in politics or have some relationship to it, or who, when we get together, they want to talk about the sequester. Like, there's not a lot of places in America where that would be true. So you run into people who know things, who wonder things, and our idea is to serve as a guide to that, to help you understand at a time when, yes, things are locked up. Yes, it looks like things aren't happening in the way, as you point out, you would normally count it. But what's going on with these human relationships with the president? Who's he talking to from outside his bubble? What's he reading? What did they decide not to do?
And you find out what he's reading. You find out what who he's talking to outside his bubble. How?
Well, interestingly enough, this president reads a lot. And this is the first president ever who does a lot of reading that his staff doesn't know about. Because for decades and decades, presidents only read what they got in their news summaries, right? And Mrs. Bush, Laura Bush, would read the paper and she would tell President Bush what was in it. But he mostly was briefed by his staff, mostly read news summaries. And as you know from covering him, staffs use this as a way to protect their politician, their principal from things that they don't want them to know or that may get them off message. This president, he surfs around on his iPad in the early morning hours, and he often finds things out there that are interesting to him that his staff hasn't found. Mrs. Obama, the girls go to bed in the evening, and he stays up. He's very much a night owl. He does, when you're president, you get homework. There's a big fat binder that comes from the staff secretary at the end of the night, and it includes who they're going to be meeting with the next day,
yeah,
their policy papers. And this president goes through that. And, you know, he has that little left-handed, he's left-handed like me, he has that left-handed chicken scratch. And that's how the press, how the staff knows that he's looked through it, because it comes back with his notes in the margins.
I guess I'm wondering, are you sort of a creation of the data electronic age? Bob Novak, when he was scouring Washington for scoops, would meet for martini lunches and do the whole thing. You're doing most of this electronically. Am I gleaning that correctly?
There's a lot of that, and I miss those martini lunches.
You don't have time for that, Mike.
You know, I think I could make time. It's just not the habit these days. You know, it's funny. Robert Novak wrote a great memoir, one of the great Washington memoirs. And Steve, wasn't something that struck you? He was very obsessed with how much he made.
Oh,
in every job, he listed what his salary had been, including his CNN contract.
He kept diaries of what he was doing, what he was writing all throughout his life, so he could chronicle it one day. Clearly, he had planned ahead.
And he and his colleague, Roland Evans, their output was amazing. And for people who complain now about being plugged in, because they wrote five columns a week, and on Saturday they had that tidbits column, six columns a week. No one does that.
No, he buckled my knees. I can't imagine that.
It after having a couple drinks at lunch, a couple pops. Maybe that helped. I don't know.
Yeah. And so, again, you do it.
Yeah. So
mostly electronically?
Yeah, Steve, to answer your question, a lot of it is electronically. We do it a lot of it on email. But the human connection is priceless. And so my habit is in the morning, I live just six blocks from Politico World Headquarters. We're in Roslyn, Virginia, part of Arlington, right across the bridge from Georgetown, so just 2 minutes outside D.C. We're owned by a company called All Britain Communications that also owns the ABC affiliate in D.C. They own seven ABC affiliates around the country. They own Channel 7 there. And so we share space with Channel 7. So the great thing about being in a TV station is there are people there around the clock. They're coming in to write the 4:30 a.m. news before the 11 p.m. news is done. So we always have company there. So I'm there in the mornings. And we do, Jim Vandehei and I do our Morning Joe hits from Politico. One of the great innovations is that we're able to have a camera there. Any cable TV station, any network can punch us up from there, because coming on radio, like with Up to Date, and going on TV like Morning Joe is an important part of how Politico has grown over 7 years. Steve, believe it or not, we have never spent a penny on advertising in 7 years. And it's because we get our name out there, tell people about our journalism, tell people about Politico in interviews like this.
There's a lot of talk, a lot of speculation about how much sleep Mike Allen gets when you go to bed and when you get up every day. So why don't you inform the world? When do you do it?
Yeah, Steve, they say that you need 6-7 hours to be
You're
healthy.
Not getting that much, Mike.
I try for that. I go for that. You know, Steve,
What time do you get up every day?
3-ish.
3 o'clock in the morning.
And interesting enough, this will interest you. I love what I do so much. I say that at Politico, every morning is Christmas morning. I enjoy doing what I do so much that I don't have an alarm clock. I have not had an alarm clock since my first job working for the Fredericksburg Freelance Star in Fredericksburg, Virginia, where I covered 2 rural counties. And I just get up because I'm so excited about the day and excited and appreciative that people like you will read it.
Are you putting together the playbook then after you get up? Is that the first thing you do?
We
or
do.
Have you done a bunch of it the night before?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And it might be good to do some of it the night before. I really don't. And there's 2 reasons that it's almost all done in the morning. One is that a good threshold for me is, what is it that I didn't know when I went to bed? Because that will interest people, and that's what I'm going to play up. But secondly, you know, I mentioned to you people always want it shorter, and because people are so busy, they're looking on their devices before they get up for breakfast or while they're on our subway, the metro. And if you have to get it out the door, that's a discipline in itself to keep it short, whereas if you did the night before, you could go on and on and on.
Mike Allen from Politico is our guest. You know, the same guy who profiled you for the New York Times has written a new book that's sort of taking D.C. by storm. It's called This Town. And he's critical of Politico in that book, Mike. He calls you all insulated, self-reinforcing, a narcissistic culture that is so much of what Washington is all about these days. How do you respond to that?
Well, Mark Leibovich in his book, This Town, I'll give him a plug there, paints Politico as being the connective tissue for all of Washington, the place that most often drives coverage.
But insulated, self-reinforcing, and narcissistic?
That does sound like Washington, I'll tell you that.
It does.
As far as Politico, before we went on the air, you told me something that Senator Dole had said in Senator Dole's voice. Why don't you do that for your listeners, Steve?
Oh, just get my name spelled right.
Exactly.
He didn't care what people said about him. Just get my name spelled right.
Right.
Yeah.
And Dole's a little easier to spell than Politico. Mark Leibovich, in this book, makes the point that Politico has tapped into what the sort of nerve center of Washington, knowing what's going to happen, know what people thinking, know why people are doing things, trying to have that barstool conversation, that over a sandwich conversation that we mentioned.
So as we sit here right now, it is 12:46. It is Wednesday afternoon Central Time. This show won't air until Thursday morning. What are you working on? What's tricking through the tumblers of your brain right now that you're looking forward to putting in Politico tomorrow morning? What kinds of stories are you watching?
Yeah, so my boss, Jim VandeHei, and I are doing a column behind the curtain about Senator Marco Rubio and how immigration didn't really work out the way that he'd expected. It was supposed to be his signature.
He was going to lead the charge.
Issue. Yeah, but now he's sort of gone underground on it. Now he's switched over and is talking more about fiscal issues. And we're sort of exploring why that is. We're still doing reporting on that. But there was more negative reaction from conservatives than I think he expected. So now he's going to be talking about abortion. He's going to be talking about defunding Obamacare. Very different from what he had planned earlier. Now, what his people tell us is that in the long run, he still has a remarkable accomplishment. And this will interest you, Steve, somebody who would be very involved in any presidential campaign involving Marco Rubio, told us that even if immigration doesn't pass, and we talked earlier about why we think it probably won't.
Yeah.
But Rubio then is the person that the Republicans most need on their ticket to make up for it. So we're
Great
working
point.
On that.
Great
also,
point.
And we just check things we hear. For instance, I heard that Vice President Cheney had called some senators before Liz Cheney announced to tell them that she was thinking about it, thinking of challenging one of their own, a sitting senator, Senator Enzi.
And he would do that why, Mike? Soften the beachhead a little bit, let people know that, hey, there's a surprise coming out of Wyoming and just prepare yourself for it?
I think that's right. And also to remind them, even if it's very subtle, and Dick Cheney isn't known for subtlety, but to remind them of the personal relationship that they have and maybe things that they'd done together or maybe things that he had done before them. And so he's signaling with this that he's on board with what she's doing. And support for Liz Cheney is support for Dick Cheney. Some people that would help with, some people that would hurt with.
I'm wondering how aggressively the Obama team works Mike Allen every day. You're in regular contact with the press secretary, Jay Carney. You're in touch often. How aggressively are they working you every day?
Well, this White House is used all the modern tools that are available to them. So they work with Playbook. They fight with us. They spin us. And they also are creating a lot of their own content. As you know from having covered it, presidents for eons have said they wanted to go around the filters. President George W. Bush did. And they used to do that by having interviews with network affiliates on the country. It was one of the ways they did that, by doing interviews with Non-Political Magazine. The President Bush did interviews with Running Magazine.
Yeah.
President Obama fills out his bracket with ESPN. And the idea of all those is that if you're listening to Up to Date or if you're reading Politico, you probably know what you think about the candidates. But if you're reading a Running Magazine or if you're watching ESPN, you might not. And so you might be a persuadable voter. And so this White House has taken that to a new level by creating their own content. It used to be that a big advance was to put a politician's speech on the web. This White House will cut it up into little slices. They call it the iPod approach, so that you can listen to just what the president said about green jobs or just what the president said about a foreign policy issue. And then they track how those are picked up. They also have White House TV, which creates its own content. They even have their own show on the weekends. They have West Wing Week that takes you behind the scenes of what's literally behind the scenes, showing footage that hasn't been shown before, something that in the past only the establishment traditional media would have done. Now this White House is doing it itself.
You know, the Times profile of you a few years ago, Mike, said this about you. He is part mascot and part sleepless narrator of our town. He is an omnipresent participant observer, abundantly kind, generous, and just unpredictable enough to make him an object of curiosity to even the most self-interested. That sound right?
Well, I hope
that Mike Allen?
I hope it's right. I try to, when I talk to young people, when I have the privilege of talking to young people, I tell them that, like, one of the ways to get ahead is to think about what the other person would react to. If you were that other person, what would you respond to? If you're a reporter trying to get information from them, if you're a flack trying to spin your story. Something else I tell young people a lot is to think about how to serve the people beside them or beneath them. Steve, we naturally serve the people above us, right?
Yeah.
We all kiss up to our bosses. But I remind young people that it's not just because it's maybe a good thing to do or because it makes you feel good. It's that if you are taking care of the intern or the fellow intern, you're going to be seen by your bosses as someone who's a very valuable part of that organization. So that's a little bit the spirit that we hope comes through in Playbook.
How important, how does it feel for you even after all these years in the business, Mike, to get a scoop?
Oh, it's fantastic.
You live for it, right?
And no, it's fantastic because it's what we're trying to do is tell people things that they don't know. And for Politico, there's a very high bar for that because we're trying to tell the chief of staff something he doesn't know. We're trying to tell the senator something she doesn't know. Politico is very focused on informing those literal insiders. And then we have an audience around the country, including here in Kansas City, that says, if it's news to a senator, if it's news to the White House chief of staff, that's probably a conversation I want to listen in on.
Something else from the New York Times profile. In 1993, it said you were covering a trial in Richmond, Virginia for the New York Times as a stringer and the Richmond Times-Dispatch, which employed him at the time. He found a payphone, darted into the street, and got whacked by a car. Allen composed himself, filed stories for both papers, and then, and only then, found his way to the hospital with a broken elbow. True story?
That is true, and your listeners will chuckle at the idea of a payphone, but at the time,
that's what it was.
Yeah, it sure was. And Steve, you can remember running for them?
Yes, I remember running, trying to make payphone calls in thunderstorms and God knows what else. Just
you were wise enough to not to run in front of a Chevrolet.
I think I've avoided that so far. Just a couple minutes left, Mike. Give me some quick assessments of our four senators from Kansas and Missouri, maybe our governors too. How about Pat Roberts, the veteran Republican from Kansas?
Yeah, now your listeners know them better than I do, and so I'm not going to judge them or give them a report card, but I will circle back to something we talked about just a second ago, and that was how news makes its way around the country. Ken Mellman, the President Bush's campaign manager in 2004, who ran the reelection campaign.
I remember him well.
Yeah.
He chewed nails for sport, I think.
I think
maybe he still does.
I think that's true. Yeah, no, he's at KKR in New York, and he was Moneyball. He pushed Moneyball on his staff, the baseball sabermetrics Bush. But something that he said that was very relevant here in Kansas City, he was saying that around the country, out here, a little place called America, as they say, out here, that in any group of 10 people, there's one person that the other nine look to for advice about movies, about books, about cars.
Opinion leaders.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, how to vote. And so that's going to be your Sunday school teacher, your local elected official, your car dealer, your small business person. And that's the person that Politico tries to reach. The person who's going to be leading, shaping, making opinion in this community, we want to inform them and we want to reach them.
Mike Allen, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time.
Steve, this was a treat. I had a fantastic time in Kansas City. Thank you very much for a great conversation here on Up to Date.